Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ahí va a llegar el gol del Arsenal. Ozil marca, Mesut Ozil, pico del área, vaya golazo de Giroud, el escorpión.
This is Arscast Extra.
Hello there, welcome to another Arscast Extra, as always, with James from Gunnar Blog. James, I'm going to wish you a goodly morning.
Goodly morning, right back at you.
Yeah.
How is your morning thus far?
It's been relatively goodly, I have to say. It's been
great.
Yeah, things have been quite goodly indeed since the weekend, since we won 4-0 at Swansea. It sort of, you know, makes the mood good. It keeps you in bright spirits. You're not worrying about life, about Arsenal. You just kind of coast along on this sea of goodliness.
It's lovely, isn't it? I mean, my Monday started terrifically. A man just rang me from a call center, seemingly not in this continent, saying that he works for a company who help people claim money if they've had accidents. And he said to me, "Have you had any accidents in the last 3 years?" I was able to tell him that he has hit the jackpot.
Have I had any accidents?
Yeah. Between me and this guy, we're going to be millionaires. I've got him ring me back after the podcast. So,
oh, brilliant.
I mean, yeah, I might not be on the podcast next week because I'll be sunning myself on my tropical island.
Yeah, sitting in a hammock, hammocking away. Yeah.
Exactly. But yeah, it has been a good weekend. I mean, I think, you know, the Arsenal result's a big part of that. And then the results yesterday didn't exactly spoil the goodly momentum.
No, they didn't. I mean, that was pretty much as much as we could have hoped for from those games. Everton against Manchester City. I mean, Everton, wow. 4-0. I know it raises questions about us, I guess, if you look back to what happened in our games. But, you know, That was an unexpected humping that Manchester City got.
Yeah, at half time, somebody tweeted me. I think it was 1-0 at half time, and they tweeted me saying, "Can't believe we lost to this lot." And I thought, I don't know which team you mean, but Everton, they looked. I mean, you know, sure, they beat us, but this was a performance on a different level to that, really. And City just didn't have an answer for it, did they? I mean, there have been games this season where they've completely dominated and missed a load of chances and it's still lost or drawn. But in this one, they were nowhere close to Ronald Koeman's side. I thought, really, really exposed in a lot of areas of the team. I mean, they've lost a couple of central midfielders, haven't they, in Fernandinho and Gundogan, and they had no answer for what Everton had in that area of the park. Mm.
Yeah, and from our point of view, obviously a good result because it means that, you know, they could have gone above us, I think, had they won, so they remained below us. And the other game, obviously, Manchester City or Manchester United and Liverpool ending in a 1-1 draw means we close the gap on Liverpool. We extend the gap over Mourinho and Manchester United, who remain, in my mind, very much like the evil empire. Like, I think if you dressed up Mourinho as the Emperor from Star Wars, it would work quite well. He's got that kind of face. That's the way his face is going to go as he gets older, isn't it? It's all crinkled with evil and nastiness just oozing from his pores.
That's it. The corrupting power of evil will eventually begin to eat his face as it has done his soul. but the draw does benefit us because obviously it keeps Liverpool very much within touching distance. It keeps United at, you know, arm's length behind. So yeah, good weekend. I mean, it is absolutely terrifying quite how intense the competition for that top four is when you look at it. I mean, that top six is so close that even when you sort of think, you can't afford to not look back as well as forward, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, there's a significant gap closed slightly, obviously, by the Everton win. But there's a big gap then to, you know, that from that top six. It is very much a top six, and it's like a slugfest, isn't it? It's six heavyweights bashing it out. Obviously, Chelsea have got a big advantage at the moment, but, you know, who knows what might happen by the time we face them. And it is, it's as competitive a Premier League season as I can remember.
Yeah, really is. So it's that odd thing of being caught between chasing the league and looking behind you at the top four. I mean, Chelsea have got that massive advantage, but I guess we should probably mention Diego Costa's shenanigans. I mean, who knows what sort of destabilising effect that might have. Didn't seem to have much effect this weekend, unfortunately.
Well, no, that's because they were playing a really quite crap team in Leicester. Yeah. And the more I see them this season, the more last season just feels even more remarkable. What happened?
Like a fever dream.
It kind of is, you know, because they are. I mean, I guess there's a certain amount now of Leicester players who went, well, look, it's never going to get any better than it did last season. Let's just enjoy the ride. A certain amount of resting on laurels going on. Big players handed big contracts, putting them perhaps in something of a comfort zone. And I think it was almost like if you were to leave your house and drive 100 miles and get a green light, every time you came to a red light, it went green. It's something like that, what happened with Leicester last season, the way that they won games and the way everyone else fell apart, really. But, you know, I was hoping for a bit more from them this weekend against Chelsea, but we'll just have to wait and see. But Costa, obviously, if he's had a big falling out, it would be a significant blow to Chelsea if that fence was not mended, which is why I think it will be.
Well, I think it has to be. I think they can't really contemplate letting him go at this point in the season. I do think his long-term future has to be in question, just because he's never seemed really settled there in London. And it's certainly true that he's got a frighteningly big offer on the table from China. And I don't know if that would turn his head. It seems it has done. Sorry, you go on.
I was just going to say, we all know Diego Costa is a massive cunt, right? There's no question about that. But I can't see him. I mean, how much of an asshole do you have to be to fuck up your season in January when you could make any move you wanted in the summer? You're playing for a team that's what, 6 or 8 points clear at the top of the table. The Premier League title looks not necessarily like a shoe-in, but you've got an amazing chance to go and win the Premier League. And then in the summer, if you don't want to stay, you just do what you got to do as a football player, as we've seen them do before. And you make your move and you take your big money. Like, a big money offer from China now is going to be there for him in the summer, probably, right? So you've got to be an enormous prick to fuck up your own season from a personal point of view and that of your team. So
unfortunately, he is.
But do you think he's that much of an enormous prick? I don't think he is. I think this will be blown over. And he'll get back on track and score goals. Because without him, Chelsea, not that they're toothless, but he's a very big part of where they are this season.
Oh, yeah. I think he's a joint top scorer, one behind Alexis at the top of the Premier League. So, yeah, I mean, look, I'm obviously hoping for the massive implosion, but I'm not, like you, I'm not too optimistic.
Yeah. Well, look, let's move on to what we did then at the weekend. 4-0 win away from home against Swansea, a team who have, in the previous two seasons, beaten us three times out of the four games that we played, home and away. So they have been something of a bogey side for us in recent years, but it would also be fair to say that this particular iteration of Swansea is much less of a team than the ones that beat us. They look an absolute shambles, don't they?
They really do. I mean, they look doomed, to be honest. And, you know, this is one of those games where you looked at it on paper and you thought, well, this is exactly the kind of away trip we need. You know, Swansea have not been playing well. They're not a good side this season. But there was that slight nagging doubt of, but they've got a new manager, you know, it's their first home game with the new coach. They'll be really up for it. And, to give them a tiny bit of credit, I actually think in the first 20 minutes, they were better than they have been in their recent games, I would imagine. I mean, there was something about them, and Arsenal weren't you know, completely on top in that first period.
Yeah.
But you saw how brittle their confidence was, I guess, once the first goal went in.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question. Do you think there's any correlation between Olivier Giroud starting games and Arsenal starting games slowly, which has been a bit of an issue for us over the last few weeks? And it has, to some extent, coincided with Giroud's return to the team.
Hmm. I think there could be. I mean, it's something I've certainly wondered about myself, because there, it's sort of a two ways of looking at the same thing, really, because he's received a lot of praise for scoring late goals.
Mm.
But you could flip that round and say, well, Arsenal aren't really scoring early goals. My hypothesis would be that as the game goes on and defences get penned deeper, it suits Giroud's style of play more.
Mm-hmm.
He becomes more effective. And we don't necessarily start out the game playing in that way. That would be my hypothesis. Would you concur? What's your point?
I don't quite know. I mean, I'm slightly conflicted about Giroud in the sense that I take my hat off to him in any number of ways that you can take your hat off to a player for the goals that he scored and the contributions that he's made since coming back. I mean, I think you can't speak highly enough about his character because he's had a difficult start to the season. He's had to accept a new role. He has also accepted a new role as a player who knows that his role is going to be diminished. You know, he signed a new contract. He's committed his future to the club. He's obviously a guy who really wants to do well. You can see that, you know, when he hurt himself against Swansea at the weekend, he wanted to stay on. And he showed, you know, perhaps maybe it wasn't the right thing to do, but, you know, it showed that the desire to do well isn't just restricted to Alexis Sanchez. The desire to push yourself is not just restricted to him either. And the goals that he scored have been fantastic. I think it's David Wall has a stat that he scored in every single one of the games that he started for Arsenal, the last 9 or 11 games, stretching back to last May. Yeah, Giroud has now scored in 9 consecutive starts for Arsenal in all competitions. That's 11 goals, a streak that goes back to last May. I think he's been absolutely great. I like him a lot as a player. I think the criticism he gets is over the top and unfair, but I still think that we should be playing Alexis Sanchez as a centre forward.
Yeah, me too.
And that's where I'm slightly conflicted. But I do wonder if there's something to the absence of Theo Walcott that plays a part in this, that the manager doesn't quite have enough faith in other players to do what Walcott does when we play Alexis up front, that sees him go with Giroud. I'm not quite sure how he's viewing it. But yeah, I mean, that's still my feeling. Despite how well Giroud has done, I feel like we play better, and I feel like we would probably start games better with Alexis up there.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You think of Alexis playing through the middle and those kind of early goals. I mean, I think of that Chelsea match, you know, when we were in New York 3-0 and how effective he was running beyond the defence in the early period of that game. I feel exactly the same. Giroud's done brilliantly, but I do feel like we found something that worked in a much more dynamic and interesting way. And I don't think it was purely aesthetic. I mean, it was, I think, more entertaining to watch as a rule, but I think it was more effective and unpredictable. And I'm kind of hoping that the return of Theo Walcott is what brings about a reversion to that. Although his absence is sort of quietly protracted, isn't it? I mean, they're talking about a couple more weeks for him. It was only ever supposed to be a few days, so fingers crossed we don't end up with a Santi Cazorla situation, you know, where gets longer and longer.
Yeah, well, that's something I think we'll touch on a bit later on. And, you know, the thing with Theo Walcott is, down the years, he has proven himself to be injury-prone. There's no getting away from that. So so there you go. But look, Giroud got the opening goal. Again, probably a goal that sums him up in a certain way. Arsenal put together a really brilliant move. Lovely move involving Ramsey and Iwobi, and Mesut Ozil played it back to Ramsey, who squared it, and Giroud just couldn't make the contact, but got himself back.
I think that's where he got injured.
Yeah.
Just when he collided with the keeper, I think, going for that ball. It was a brilliant pass from Ozil, amazingly.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of the thing that you don't even comment on because you're so used to seeing it, but a brilliantly weighted pass for Ramsey in the build-up.
There. Yeah, it was good. Ball came to Alexis, cross back in, Ozil's header, and it fell to Giroud, who banged it home with his right foot. So, I mean, that was a timely goal, obviously, to get one just before halftime. And after that, I don't think Swansea didn't really do an awful lot. And in the second period, we had what I thought was a really outstanding performance from Alex Iwobi.
Yeah, no, you won't find any argument for me on that. I mean, I've really, really enjoyed watching Iwobi in the last few weeks. It's funny because it wasn't too long ago we were chatting on here about him looking a bit tired and a bit jaded, and he came out of the side for a few weeks, and Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain appeared to be taking advantage of that, but Iwobi's really stormed back, and I think part of that's physical. I think part of it is confidence as well. There are a couple of goals which helped him. But what he showed at Swansea, I mean, it's a shame. It looks like he's going to have that first goal taken away from him.
Mm.
But his contribution was enormous. Two assists for the own goals and heavily involved in the move for the 4-2. And, you know, whether he's playing on the right or the left or popping up in the middle, I'm so glad he's not at the African Nations. I'm sorry to any Nigerian listeners, but he's in terrific form, and I just love watching him. Everything he does is so smooth and mature and deliberate, and he's really coming into his own right now.
Yeah, it's fantastic to see this young guy, you know, who's come through the academy at Arsenal to make a breakthrough, to have the faith shown in him by Arsene Wenger, to be rewarded by the performances on the pitch. You know, I think I've seen people criticise him, and I'm going, look, Jesus, he hasn't even been 12 months in the Arsenal first team. He's 20 years of age. Look at what he can do when he does it. You know, he's not going to be Mr. Consistent straight away. He's still a guy who's learning. And what I really like about him is every time you see him interviewed, whenever you see him take part in something, he's very grounded. He seems very humble, very willing to learn. He's not a big head egomaniac who thinks he's, you know, God's gift or anything like that. And I think that attitude is going to be something that stands him in good stead going forward.
Yeah, I mean, he's a dynastic footballer, you know, the nephew of JJ Okocha, but he doesn't approach it with any kind of entitlement at all. And he, I think Arsene Wenger's talked about his humility, and I do think that comes across. I mean, he seems like a very likeable guy as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's partly, you know, why you warm to him, because he just seems like a very sort of sweet kid.
Yeah.
And obviously someone who's come through the Arsenal Academy, so it's great to see him excelling. I have to say, initially as an Englishman, I was kind of disappointed a little bit that he chose to, just, you know, obviously he should make his own choice, but he chose to represent Nigeria. But now, with a bit of distance from it, I think it probably spares him a lot of scrutiny in this country.
Well,
and
yeah,
I think that's probably a good thing, you know.
Yeah, in some ways, yes. But you know, if he had been, let's say, in inverted commas, an English man or an English international, I do think that there would be, yeah, increased scrutiny, but I think people will be talking about him with much more reverential terms. Certainly he would be in the press being held up as, you know, a great talent, and he's sort of flying under the radar a little bit, and in some ways that could be beneficial.
Yeah, I agree that he probably deserves a little more credit, or would certainly get a lot more attention if he were English, but then sometimes I look at the way the press, you know, occasionally go after someone like a Raheem Sterling, say, and I wonder if maybe he wishes he'd chosen to represent Jamaica. Do you know what I mean? I think it's like, I think that it's a double-edged sword, isn't it? But I think for the most part, for Arsenal, you know, we know his value, and Arsene Wenger knows his value, because I don't think many players have been involved in more games this season.
Yeah, that's a fair point. That's a fair point. We can enjoy what he does, and, you know, the rest of them can take it whatever way they want to take it. So, yeah, really, really positive half from him. And he was involved also in the fourth goal, because he had the first goal that looped in. He forced the own goal. I think it's fair to say as well that even if there was a little bit of good fortune about the first own goal, or the first goal that Iwobi scored, whatever way you want to give it, it came at the end of a period of really intense Arsenal pressure. They were basically hammering the door down and found a way through, and we got just reward for that.
Yeah, I think I tweeted it at the time. It was one of those periods of pressure. We're like, this is when Arsenal need to score, because we were so on top, and it felt like this is the chance to kill the game. And to be fair, we did exactly that. Mm. I mean, on that goal, maybe it doesn't matter enormously, but are you of the mind that that's an own goal, or would you credit that to Iwobi, the first one?
It's very difficult to know quite where the shot was going. I think it was definitely a shot. There's no question about that. The second one, no doubt that's an own goal. But the first one, I think had it been very obviously on target and going into the net, and the guy had stuck his foot out and deflected it in, then I think you give it as a goal. I can understand why he wants to claim it. But because there was such a short distance between him and Jack Cork, who stuck his leg out and deflected it over Fabianski, it's a bit more difficult to give it as his goal. But I think it's fair to give him credit for making the goal happen, even if he doesn't necessarily end up with the goal being awarded to him.
Yeah. I guess he'd be credited with an assist, maybe. I don't know. I'd probably like to see him given a goal for that, just because, from my point of view, I think it is a shot on target. I think that should be the criteria, but you're right, it's difficult to discern exactly where it would have ended up. Mm. But anyway, so that was the first one. Second one, yeah, he went down the left, and the ex-Spurs man, Carl Norton, prodded it into the net, which I enjoyed. And the fourth goal, well, Iwobi did brilliantly on the left, you know, showing power and skill, and then I think Oxlade-Chamberlain, was it, put it in from the right.
Yeah, it was a lovely pass from Iwobi. You know, when you look at the pass again, it was a lovely little reverse pass to put Oxlade-Chamberlain in behind.
Yeah, that's right. And then it came out, Aaron Ramsey sort of couldn't quite get a shot away. And the finish from Alexis Sanchez looked absolutely routine, but I thought was actually a quite brilliant piece of skill to sort of take it on the volley and the turn and just lift it beyond Fabianski.
Yeah, it was great. It was real instinctive finishing that. You know, he saw the ball coming and just hooked it in. It was really good. I think it's because it's the fourth goal in what appeared to be a fairly routine win, it got slightly overlooked, and maybe also overlooked because Sanchez is capable of doing that and much more. He's been excellent this season, and that was just another really brilliant goal. So I think that's 15 goals for him already this season, which brings us, of course, to the substitution. How do you feel? I watched your on the whistle video, and you seemed a little bit put out by it in the heat of the moment, in the cold light of day. What's your thoughts?
I still think it's over the top, you know. I understand it, but I was like, come on, man, give us a break. And part of the reason I feel like that is because I know that that sort of incident is going to create a whole media storm that's not necessarily justified, but that we will have to endure because things will be read into his behaviour. And my suspicion is that he probably doesn't care or think about that because he's a very passionate person. But cynically, I'm a bit like, I don't want to have to talk about Alexis Sanchez's future again for a little bit.
Sure. You know? But I mean, do you think the most cynical outlook on it is that he is creating an atmosphere or scenarios in which he can point to those and go, look, I care so much. It's only because I care so much, and that's why I've got to leave, or that's why I've got to get 300 grand. I think that's the most.
He's Diego Costa-ing his way out somehow. that's the most cynical. Yeah. I did mention that, but I don't think that that's the case. I mean, frankly, my impression of Alexis is that if he decides he wants to leave, he'll probably do that and not feel too bad about it, and it'll be fairly clinical anyway. Do you know what I mean? He's a professional. I don't think there's going to be a Robin Van Persie-style letter to the guys. I think he's just going to go if he wants to go. So I don't think that's it. I think it's literally just, look, it's just a bit of petulance, isn't it? It's a thing of, I want to play, I don't want to be taken off. I mean, it is crazy that he can't see the logic to it, but I guess that is also endearing about him as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure that he can see the logic, but probably needs a few minutes to calm down and see what it is. I mean, to my mind, there's absolutely no question that that was the right decision from Arsene Wenger to take off Ozil and to take off Sanchez. The game is won. We're 4-0 up. The last thing you want is for him to turn an ankle or pull a hamstring or for some wanker to like push him off the pitch like Norwich last season or the season before and he could end up hurting himself. You know, it's over. It's done and dusted. We have bigger fish to fry and more difficult games coming up. And in some ways, taking him off is almost like a compliment. It's saying to him, you are so important to this team that we don't need you to run yourself ragged. I think it was interesting. Arsene Wenger said he's a guy who wants to fight everywhere, sometimes where he shouldn't. And I think it's difficult to separate the two things from his character, right? That this desire that he has to be involved and to win, you know, that everybody loves him. He's a winner. He's, you know, he shows such passion, all that kind of stuff, that in some ways it is tied in with that reaction when he comes off.
Yeah,
you know,
it is.
And I do agree with you to a certain extent. It's over the top. And it is perhaps a little bit of, there's a little bit of cynical posturing to it. I do have my nagging doubts, but ultimately, I don't think it really matters that much. I think probably someone will have a quiet word that if and when this happens again, look, just take it for what it is and come off the pitch and sit on the bench with your teammates and enjoy the fact that, you know, you've played a part in helping us win 4-0. But I don't think it's a huge issue.
Does he like his teammates? Like, I can't ever tell. Do you know what I mean? Like, does he ever seem happy with them on the pitch?
I don't know that he really likes anyone, apart from his dogs.
It feels like I mean, I don't want to pry into his private life, but I don't know anything about his private life at all, apart from his dogs. I mean, maybe he's just not a people person.
I think he probably is very, very much an individualist. I think we can see that in the way that he plays. I mean, he was at the basketball during the week. Did you see that? All the Arsenal players went to the basketball, to the NBA that was in London, and he was out with them. He was there with his agent, which might be a sign that perhaps the agent is in London to have some talks about his future. So, but he was there with the chaps, and, you know, look, who knows? He does, you know, sometimes if you see the, you know, when the game is over and the TV cameras are around and the players are shaking hands with each other and what have you, you know, he's happy enough to high five with the guys and, you know, do the old, yes, we've won, little bit of a hug and what have you.
Sure.
But he does strike me as, yes, on the pitch, he demands the absolute best from everyone, while at the same time not necessarily doing it himself. I mean, there were a couple of times where he was unhappy at a pass that went astray, but he's quite capable of making terrible passes himself. You know, this is just part of the yin and yang of him, I guess. I wouldn't say it's a case that he doesn't like his teammates, but I don't think he's perhaps the most demonstrative in that regard. Would that be fair?
Yeah, it is. I think that's true. It's just that, like, you said that thing of, like, oh, you know, he could go and sit on the bench and enjoy the, you know, the fact that the team have fallen up and he's won. I just suddenly thought back and I thought, I don't think I've ever seen him sat on the bench, you know, having been substituted, like, high-fiving and, you know, kicking back with the guys. But I guess that's just because he wants to be, above all else, he wants to be on the field. And I do think that attitude is what we admire about him and what makes him a great player. I mean, I think, you know, obviously technically he's very, very good, but I actually do think it's his sort of competitive streak and individualist nature that elevates him actually to make him a great player rather
sure.
than a good one.
Sure. And I think it's fair to point out as well that people, just because they don't react in the way that Alexis reacts, or they don't necessarily, they're not quite as upfront about their desire to win, or not so visibly, it's not so visibly apparent, doesn't mean that they don't care either. You know, you don't get to this level of football if you're happy just to, well, whatever. You know, I think they all do,
sure.
But it's different. And obviously, when it's as public as Alexis makes it, it's divisive. I mean, it was quite funny to see a lot of fans react afterwards by saying, well, you know, he can fuck off and he can go and all this kind of stuff. It's like, it's bizarre.
Really?
Yeah,
I didn't see
yeah.
that. That's, wow.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Well, now, in fairness, a lot of it was on Facebook, which is which is at times a home for the most extreme opinions, shall we say. But, yeah. you know, to me, it's just, it's bizarre. Like, I can understand why you might not like what he did, but the idea of telling him to fuck off or he can go, that is very much cutting off your nose to spite your face territory for me.
Well, I mean, once we've sold him for that, and then we've sold Olivier Giroud for his scorpion celebration, and then we can sell Mesut Ozil for him saying that he won't decide his future until Arsene Wenger decides his.
Yeah.
We can, you know, finally do the cull on this squad that we desperately need.
Absolutely, yeah. Ozil, he's too languid. That's what it is. His body language is all wrong. We should sell him and get 11 Alexis Sanchez's.
See, he was delighted to come off Ozil. Delighted to come on.
Oh, God. Anyway, look, a good weekend, all in all. And I think when you look at the next two fixtures that we have in the Premier League, we've got Watford and then we've got Burnley, then there's an FA Cup game, and then there's Watford. We're in a good position after that stumbling week where we lost to Everton, we lost to Manchester City. Obviously, the Bournemouth game wasn't particularly great, but, you know, we're beginning to move in the right direction again. So it's a positive. It's been a positive weekend for the most part.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, two home games coming up in the league at least, and two sides that don't travel brilliantly. So yeah. I mean, look, this is the period where we're saying we're trying to make ground on Chelsea before we play them at Stamford Bridge, which is February 4th. Couple more chances to do that. I mean, you know, I'm not massively anticipating Chelsea dropping points anytime soon, but if we can at least have a head of steam when we go there, we've got a better chance of getting some kind of result.
Yeah. All right. Well, just one final thing. A lot of people said that we should just bring Alexis's dogs to the game, so when he is taken off, he can just sit there and play with the dogs. So that, yeah.
Yeah, that's a very good idea.
Are you allowed dogs on the bench, I wonder? Probably not.
I don't know.
Oh, you could say they're probably assistance dogs, aren't they? I mean, like, if Alexis was blind, he'd be allowed to have his dog.
Exactly. All we need to do is blind Steve Bold, and then we can get the dogs on there as his guides.
Absolutely,
It seems like a small price to pay.
Say goodbye to your eyes, Steve Bold. Yeah. It's for the greater good. All right, well, look, we're going to leave it there. We'll come back with part two and your questions right after this.
So happy. So happy. This is fantastic. So happy. Fantastic. The fans so happy. This is fantastic. So happy.
So happy. This is fantastic.
So happy. This is fantastic. Fantastic. So happy I go to golf with my dog.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome back to the Arscast Extra. This is the part of the show where we answer questions that you send to us on Twitter at Gunnarblog and at Arsblog, and also on the Arsblog Facebook page, which is facebook.com/TheArsblog. James, I'm going to give you the honor this morning. You go right ahead with the first question.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome. You're welcome.
It's been a great day.
What an honour.
This question comes from George Bushell, then, who's at that guy, George B, on Twitter. And he asks, what are the chances of Wojciech Szczesny returning this summer to reclaim his number one jersey and with it the first choice goalkeeper spot?
Slim. I would say. I like Chesney. I have never closed the door on Wojciech since his departure. I would like to see him come back, to be honest.
He's having a very good season, yeah, by all accounts.
Yeah. It's almost as if, you know, he's playing regular football and he's grown up a bit and has matured a bit as a player. I think he's going to be 26, 27 next birthday. You know, he'll have had two seasons away in Serie A. It gives him a different footballing perspective, I guess. I wouldn't rule it out 100%. I think much will depend on what David Ospina wants to do. Because obviously he's been given the Champions League games this season and he's playing in the FA Cup and he's essentially our cup goalkeeper. But I do wonder if, for him, at this stage of his career, if that's enough. You know, he's number one for his country. He'll want to be playing week in, week out. I guess that's what most players do. I don't think Ospina doesn't strike me as a Stuart Taylor kind of a guy who's happy to just never play. So I think there's a decision to be made there. If you can see Ospina being given the number one jersey at Arsenal, would that convince him to stay? Maybe it would, but I'm not sure that's what's going to happen. So if he decides to go, we then have a Petrček who is not getting any younger, and then we have a bit of a gap to Emi Martinez, who is just signed a new deal, of course, and a promising goalkeeper. Not young, he's 24, I think, now, Martinez, but again, there's an experience gap there with him, isn't there? He hasn't played a huge amount. So I think we definitely need a goalkeeper to challenge Cech, and I do wonder if Chesney, with his love of Arsenal, having grown up at the club, would be the ideal candidate for that. So I'd like to see it happen, but I'm not necessarily sure it will. So there, that's what I think.
If you could choose, I mean, if you could choose for next season to have Cech, Martinez, and then one of Ospina or Chesney, which one would you choose?
Chesney.
Is that on goalkeeping ability, or is that on just
personal preference? You know, I just like Chesney. What can I tell you? I know some people
like Chesney.
I just like Chesney. I mean, what's wrong with that? I don't have to justify that to you or anybody else, God damn it. I just like him. What can I tell you? You know, people have their favorites and people might say, well, look, he's a dickhead, or he's a, you know, I wrote a blog about it last week, the 10 reasons why we should bring him back. You know, some of it was slightly tongue-in-cheek, but part of it is just I really like him. I think he's a good character. I think he's got a bit of mentalness to him, which I think is probably necessary in most goalkeepers. I just like him. What can I can't explain it any better than that. And I don't necessarily hate
Ospina.
That's
the nature of love.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
The heart wants what it wants, James.
I know. Well, I like him too, actually, and
not as much.
Maybe
as me.
Absence. No, I don't think so. Clearly, but I think absence makes the heart grow fonder as well. And that I sort of I find myself yearning for him more than I ever did. But I always viewed his mentalness as a similar kind of mentalness to the one that made Jens Lehmann great. You know, the question is really if he would come back to play the Ospina role in the squad, having been first choice at Roma for 2 years. You know?
Yeah, that's fair.
Like, if Arsene Wenger keeps faith with Petrček, as seems likely, to be honest, then Chesney's chances are limited at Arsenal anyway. But I don't know. Do you think the fact that he's been sent on loan for 2 years in a row suggests that there is a chink of light for him, that Arsene Wenger would have dispensed with him permanently if he didn't think maybe he'll come back?
Yeah, I mean, my information is that they didn't close the door on him when they sent him on loan. It was not a case, right, let's get him out of the club any way we can. You know, they put a lot of work into Wojciech Chesney. You know, he became first choice at 19 or 20 years of age, which shows that they saw talent in him and potential in him. And it went a bit arseways. And sometimes that happens, and maybe a player needs to mature and needs to grow up. So I don't think the door is closed on him coming back. But again, it depends on the circumstances, I think.
Yeah, well, Well, there we go. Maybe we'll see Wojciech next year.
We will. That would be nice. Okay, here is a question from Gaz Roberts, who's at GazRoberts1. And he says, with his injury record, would you renew Cazorla? And who would be a suitable long-term replacement? The replacement thing we don't necessarily have to touch on because it's very difficult to find a player exactly like him, which is something we've spoken about. But it's a concern, isn't it? The news that we got last week that he's had to undergo another little procedure for the Achilles, and Arsene Wenger has put his participation in this season in doubt a little bit because of this injury.
It's a real blow. It's a real blow, and it's a real shame because he's so fantastic to watch, and also because, you know, Per Mertesacker as well is in the final year of his contract. They've not had much luck, have they, those two guys? And I guess maybe that's a sign. It could just be misfortune, or it could be a sign that physically, you know, things are beginning to take their toll on them slightly. Would I extend his contract? Possibly. Yeah, probably, because he is such a unique talent. And as much as you love Szczesny, I love Santi. You know, I think he's brilliant. I think he's marvellous. And I think that if he can, I guess he'd have to come back and sort of demonstrate some sign that he was going to return to fitness before the end of the season. I mean, everything suggests that the Arsenal team knew that he had this underlying issue, that this was a possibility, that this could happen this season. It's gone that way. But I think because of the difficulty of replacing him, I'd look to keep him on, and I think it's a risk, but, you know, we've seen Arsene Wenger prepared to take that risk with plenty of players in the past.
Do you not fear that, like, he's 32 years of age now, and that's clearly not over the hill, but certainly heading into the autumn...
The twilight
of his career to an extent. Is there not a danger that by keeping him... And I love him too. I love watching him. I think he's absolutely sensational as a footballer. But people have said, you know, we're quite reliant. We have to find a way to play without Santi Cazorla. Would that in some ways make that process a little more difficult if Cazorla was still around?
Yeah, possibly. Possibly. There's certainly an argument that could be the case. I guess I would sort of keep him around, but not necessarily lean on him quite so heavily because, you know, he's out at the moment, and as much as it's a problem for us, it is also a positive thing that we're seeing other people get a chance to establish a midfield partnership. I mean, Ramsey and Xhaka played again at the weekend, and it's very early to make calls on that, but there's definitely potential in it. I thought Aaron Ramsey actually had a really good performance at Swansea, you know, and I think watching him link up with Mesut Ozil again and link up with Alex Iwobi, and he plays well off Giroud too, you know, you saw his potential in that central midfield role. So I guess I'm just finding it hard to acknowledge that and let go of Santi. I think that, you know, given the choice to keep him, I probably would. So do you think you'd be able to be like, oh no, let's call it a day, let's go our separate ways?
I don't know. I mean, I think there's been a tendency down the years from Arsene Wenger and from the club to show loyalty to players at a stage in their career when they've given a lot to the club, and when perhaps, if you were being completely cynical and harsh, you might say that was the wrong decision, you know? But again, on the one hand, people want to talk about Arsenal as a club that has class and all that kind of stuff. So do you, you know, turf a guy out because he's knackered or his injury problems are chronic? You know, it's a very difficult decision for the club to make. I guess it will depend on what the long-term prognosis is for Santi Cazorla. Is this surgery going to repair that Achilles problem to the extent where he can play at his highest level again? Because that's what we need. And if there's doubts, you know, it will depend on the prognosis, on the medical prognosis. It is really difficult. I mean, I would be inclined to say yes, keep him, but whether or not he would ever be a first choice player for us again, I have my doubts about that. I have serious doubts about whether he could be and whether he should be. That's the other side of the coin, you know, that people talk about, how do you find a replacement for Cazorla? I don't think you do. I think you find a different way to play. You've got to find a different combination in midfield. And whether Cazorla can then fit into that system, I'm not sure.
Yeah. I mean, I just can't. When you look at European football, it is difficult to pick out players who are quite as good at him. What he does. So it felt like, you know, I always said it felt like something that happened slightly by accident, putting Santi Cazorla in that deep lying midfield role. And I don't think anyone anticipated him being as good there as he was.
Yeah.
And I think that it was lovely for a time, but we probably have to find something that's more, well, certainly more reliable on the fitness front from now on. Good luck with that in the Arsenal squad.
Yeah.
let's have another question. So, Mark Lee at Morphic Field says, today is Nicholas Bentner's birthday. Who would you say was the worst striker we have had in the Arsene Wenger era?
Oh, my goodness. Who was the worst? I mean, I guess
shouts for Kaba Diawara.
Yeah, I mean, that's
I remember
that's
him
fair.
Fondly, though. I remember him as a guy who, like, kept hitting the bar in the post, but had those gone in. You know,
I don't remember him that fondly, because I think, was it that game against Leeds when and he hit the post a couple of times in that game, and then we conceded, was that the one where we conceded the late goal to Hasselbank, and pretty much fucked our title chances. So I don't necessarily remember Kaba Diawara with any great fondness, to be perfectly honest. But again, he's a guy whose expectations of him were pretty low, weren't they? So
yes, you've got I think he came on loan.
Yeah, you've got to balance.
All permanently, briefly.
Yeah, you've got to balance the expectation and perhaps the price tag with what we got from a player. I mean, someone who was really disappointing was, I guess, Francis Jeffers would have been one, considering how much money we paid for him at the time, £8 or £9 million, which was high back then, but obviously was never able to stay fit. So he was disappointing. Who else?
Jeffers is a good shout. I mean, Park, inevitably, there'll be calls for Park, but you know, what were expectations for Park, you know?
What did you say? Park, hang on, what was it?
Sorry, I said Park. On your mouth, you got trouble on your mouth. Trouble on your mouth. Oh, man.
Sorry. I had to.
That brings back memories.
It sure does. Yeah. Park, again, but that was a bizarre, weird transfer for, what, £2.5 million in that mental summer of 2011, last minute, last ditch. I don't know who the fuck made that decision, but that really didn't work out at all. But again, it was he was not a guy who we expected to come in and score lots of goals, I don't think.
No, I'm just trying to think, really. I mean, you know, by the end, Marouane Chamakh was a disaster, but he burned so brightly early on.
yeah, he did. He had a good start, didn't he? But, you know, he was a free transfer. So, you know.
Remember that, when we didn't have any money? Terrible times.
I mean, Podolski, maybe as well. I think was brought in as a striker, but that experiment didn't last very long.
Well, if you assessed him purely on his performances as a striker, as a number nine, then he was probably one of the very worst, because he didn't play at all ever well there.
Yeah.
There've been a few concerns. I suspect it's someone from the kind of the Chris Ray Kaba Diawara era, probably. There's probably someone we're forgetting, a Fabian Caballero or something like that.
Yeah, but again, those are guys who were not really expected to have any significant impact. You know, a big money.
If anything, Chris Ray exceeded expectations.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, has there been like a big money striker signing that has been a complete flop?
Oh, Jose Reyes, maybe.
Yeah, again, bought as kind of a wide man more than a striker.
I think in terms of expectations, though, you know, there was so much excitement, and it really petered out for him. I think Jeffers is a good shout.
Yeah,
that,
I think
did not work out.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not really relevant because he wasn't entirely a striker, but a separate question. Luis Anguna at Ricky Turn has tweeted in, do you ever think to yourself, man, I really miss Jovinho? I mean, no is the answer.
I, you know, no would also be my answer. I've tried very hard to forget Gervinho on as many levels as possible.
I mean, we talked about Leicester winning the league feeling like a fever dream. I feel somewhat the same about Gervinho's Arsenal career.
I suppose in time we might be able to look back and laugh. But not yet.
It's really bizarre at times. It was really bizarre at times.
It was weird. Didn't he get sent off on his debut?
I think he did against Newcastle, yeah.
A little thing with Joey Barton. And, I think people had some sympathy for him for that. But I have to say, his ability to trap a football further than most people can kick it was remarkable. I remember, wasn't there one? It could have been against Manchester City. And it was just the most classic piece of Arsenal football you ever saw. Tore the defence apart, a beautiful ball straight through. He's like clean through on goal. All he had to do was just take a touch and finish, and he fucking clumped it almost straight into the arms of the goalkeeper, and you're going, oh my God. You get paid so much money just to be able to control a football. You know, you look at some of the players and, a high ball comes in and they stick a foot out and they cushion it and they bring it down. And it's, we look at that as almost matter of fact. And it's absolutely, it's amazing skill to be able to do that. And then you look at Gervinho and think, why did this happen to us?
Extraordinary thing. I don't know. And what's weirdest about it is that his previous club, Lille, he was excellent. And at Roma, I think he had a bit of a renaissance. So it was just some incredible chemistry of Arsenal and Gervinho just did not work at all, didn't it? But at one time, he was the solution at number nine. Do you remember that?
Yeah. Oh, God.
Heady days.
Oh, fucking hell. And people think things are bad now. Holy shit.
Did he score a hat-trick for us once? Have I made that up?
I think you have, yeah.
I think that was a fever dream.
That definitely was. You're on the good drugs that day, that's for sure. Didn't score. Did he score?
Oh, right.
I don't know. I'm going to have a look now and see did he ever score in more
Gervinho
than...
hat-trick. I'm Gervinho praises outstanding Gervinho. Osmenga praises the outstanding Gervinho after he inspired the Gunners to a 4-1 romp over Reading.
Right.
The Ivorian, starting his first Premier League game since December. Oh, no, he could have grabbed a hat-trick. That's the crucial phrase.
He could have.
The former Liverpool could have grabbed a hat-trick.
Right.
Arsene Wenger told Sky Sports, he is what you want from a striker. Dangerous, he scored and gave assists. The only regret is that he had a few more chances to score. But you cannot fault his performance today. He was absolutely outstanding.
But that was the thing. There were times where you went, holy shit, this guy could be really fucking good. He scored twice against Southampton in a 6-1 win. And he got 9 goals in 2012-13. But it's fairly safe to say it was a transfer that did not work out. Yeah, no, he never scored a hat-trick. And I think, we've gone beyond the main point of this, which, of course, is to wish Nicholas Bentner a happy birthday, quite literally the greatest striker that has ever lived.
Of course, the greatest striker of all time. Mm. Happy birthday, Nick. Your question.
It is indeed my question, and all I have to do is find one. Okay, here's one from Chris Garment at GarmenticAh on Twitter. He said, if you could combine any two of Alexis, Ozil, Henry and Bergkamp to make a super player, which two would it be?
Alexis, Henry,
Ozil and Bergkamp. So you need to make one super player from any two of those.
Ooh, I like it. I think it would be, any two are going to be good. Let's be clear about that,
yeah.
Right? Any combo there is going to be pretty strong. So it strikes me that there's kind of two categories of player there. I feel like Alexis and Henri are sort of kind of a type, and then Ozil and Bergkamp are kind of a type. Now, you could combine Alexis and Henri, and if you put Henri's athleticism and grace with Alexis's ingenuity and desire, you'd have a pretty unstoppable striker. But equally, I think to get the... I think to get the most rounded, brilliant player, you want to take sort of a little from column A, a little from column B. So...
Henry was quite creative. People forget, you know, that he was...
That's true.
He was a creative force as well as a goal-scoring one. He got a lot of assists.
That is true, actually. I think I would take... Oh, I don't know, you know. I mean, the funny thing is, if you could give Ozil a little bit of Alexis, oh, what a player you'd have there.
Yeah.
His finishing ability and kind of trying and stuff. No, I think, I mean, I'm finding it very hard to just not say Bergkamp and Henri. And I wonder if that's because of their kind of legendary status. I feel like Ozil and Alexis are kind of the modern counterparts who haven't quite reached that level. So I think Bergkamp and Henri, I think you get a pretty handy kind of, you know, 9.5 striker out of that. I can't think of many things they couldn't do between them. What would you say?
You know, just to be different, I'm going to say Bergkamp and Ozil.
What would that look like?
I don't know quite what it would look like, but it would be capable of scoring goals, and it would surely, if you added Bergkamp's creativity to Ozil's creativity, you could play Gervinho up front. And you create so many chances that even when he missed 9 of them, he'd score the 10th one. You know, I think that would be something I'd like to see.
I think that's true. I think what Bergkamp would give Ozil is kind of composure in front of goal and a little bit of needle as well. Let's not forget that about Dennis. And I think what Ozil would give Bergkamp, one of the things that strikes out of me is... it's kind of stamina, like ability to cover ground. I mean, Bergkamp was kind of a 10 or a striker, but Ozil is a more of a midfield player. If you look at how much ground he covers in any one game, he's kind of everywhere on the pitch. And having Bergkamp be that mobile would be very dangerous indeed. Ooh. So, yeah. I like it. I like it. I think in the future, I hope that this sort of thing will actually be possible.
Yes.
And we can make these dreams come true.
Yes. I mean, if in Futurama, people's heads can live on in jars, pretty much anything could happen.
Exactly.
All right.
And Futurama is, as far as I'm aware, some sort of Tomorrow's World-style documentary.
It definitely is. It's a glimpse into our future, a terrifying future that it might be, but it still is.
So the next question is from the Facebook, as the kids call it, and it's from Stefan Bergkamp Grottom. I don't know if Bergkamp's his real middle name. If it is, I congratulate his parents.
Yes, that would be a marvelous thing to bestow upon any child. I name this child James Bergkamp McNicholas.
I actually might name my child Bergkamp as a middle name. I think it's got a certain. I like it. Bergkamp McNicholas sounds good.
Yeah.
Maybe I should marry Dennis and breed. So I feel like I know your answer to this. It's a bit like the Gervinho question, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
Okay.
Payet, should we go in with a sneaky bid? He can cover a lot of positions and also maybe become Cazorla's replacement at central midfield.
No.
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 It's a no from you.
It's definitely a no from me.
And is that... entirely on his playing ability, or is that informed by his character?
A little bit of both. I think he's a good player, but he's, 29 now?
Yeah.
And clearly a wanker.
Well, there's that, yeah.
And look, you know, I don't think we can cast too many aspersions on footballers who decide they don't want to play at a club. It happens all the time. You know, the way he's behaved is not great, but, you know, he's not alone in that. He's not a unique case in that regard. I just feel like he's a player that when the chips are down or when you really need someone to dig in, I think it's apparent that he's not that guy. He's not the guy who's got the character who can really lift a team. He scores some good free kicks, but
very good.
I don't think that's enough. I don't think that's enough.
I also don't think he's a Cazorla. Like, when we talk about Cazorla, we think of him now as a kind of deep player, whereas I think Payet's an attacking player. So I don't think that's a particularly appropriate comparison. I just think, yeah, look, Arsene Wenger has said himself, he's looked at Payet many, many times. Maybe he couldn't have anticipated, well, I don't think anyone could have anticipated the impact he would have at West Ham in that first season. But if he'd wanted him in the past, he could have had him, I'm sure. And he's not done that. I don't see that changing anytime soon.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure it should, especially in the light of this, yeah, the recent turn of events, which doesn't paint him in a particularly positive light.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he's 30 in March, so that's not a guy for the future. And I don't think, like you say, he can play the Cazorla role. I'm just looking at his stats here. So last season he had 9 goals and 12 assists for West Ham. Previous season for Marseille, 7 goals and 16 assists. Season before that, slightly less. For Lille, he had 12 goals and 13 assists in 2012-13. So he's a guy who's enjoyed, you know, a good second period to his career as he heads towards 30 years of age. But no, I wouldn't go near him at all.
Okay, well, that's sorted.
Indeed. This one comes from Raj Sapadeen, who's also on the Facebook. We are sure. The Facebook, of course. And he says, if you could take Serge Gnabry back, as per today's newspaper malarkey, would you?
What is the precise? I haven't read the malarkey.
The malarkey. Have you read it? Yeah, it was in the Malarkey Express, basically. Gnabry said he's enjoying playing for Werder Bremen. But look, if Chelsea or Arsenal came back in for me in the summer, I'd certainly consider it. Something like that.
Right.
So that's right.
I mean, he's having a good season in the Bundesliga, according to his stats. Anyway, he's got 7 goals from 15 appearances. I mean, he's a good player. He's very talented, and he seems to be free from injury, which has always been the main thing for him. The only way I could see him coming back to Arsenal is if Arsenal have worked in some kind of canny buyback clause, which we did used to, I think, do things like that. But I certainly haven't read anything to suggest that would be the case in this instance. If anything, it seems a bit like he's destined to end up at Bayern Munich. Maybe he's just throwing that out as a red herring to kind of cover whatever shady deal that is.
Wasn't there some talk about that Bayern were involved in this deal with Werder Bremen? Yeah. That, you know, his dad, I think, had said something to that effect or something like that. So, yeah, it's a strange situation. I felt like he should have stayed. I understand why he wanted to go, and there's no question that Arsenal wanted to keep him. Arsene Wenger was very explicit about wanting to keep him. And you can probably see why, because of what he's doing in the Bundesliga thus far. I mean, if you think about it, in some ways, he's a little bit like Iwobi in the sense that he was given a chance in the team at a time when the team was, I'm not going to say necessarily struggling, but when other players hadn't been terribly convincing. And you can point to Iwobi coming into the team against Barcelona last season at the expense of someone more experienced like Theo Walcott, right? And Gnabry was given a go in the team as well when we weren't necessarily at our best and we needed something fresh. And it looked for a time like he was a guy who could give us that. I remember a game, was it away against maybe Crystal Palace, and I think he scored away against Swansea as well. You know, the potential was there, but the injuries obviously played a big part in that. I mean, look, would I take him back? Maybe, yeah.
Do you think he would have got games looking at the way the squad's formulated this year?
If he had stayed, I do wonder if we would have bought Lucas Perez, for example.
Right. Yeah.
So I think had he stayed, I don't know that we would necessarily have brought in another attacking player, which would then have given him chances to play games. I think he would have been on the bench a bit. I think he would have played in the Capital One Cup games, the FA Cup games. I think in some of the European games, he might have been given a chance, and then it would have been up to him. I think he would have been given a chance. I think he would have been given games by Arsene Wenger, but obviously we were unable to reach any kind of agreement with him about his future, and the club decided, well, given that, we'll sell him. But I'm a little bit surprised that we didn't include some kind of either sell-on clause or an option on him were he to go on and perform. Because that's the big risk, isn't it, about young players when you let them go, when you invest a lot in them and they don't quite make the breakthrough. All those things that you saw in the player in the first place are still there. And if they go on somewhere else to fulfill that potential, then, you know, it's a bit heartbreaking, I guess. So I'm a bit surprised, but maybe that was just part of the deal.
Yeah, I mean, Madrid and Barcelona are quite good in that respect, aren't they? When they let players go, they often build something in. You look at what happened with Morata.
Yeah, I mean, that was
this summer.
Yeah, so ridiculously complicated, wasn't it, you know?
I know. But, I mean, I guess they're protecting themselves, aren't they,
yeah,
against, you know, exactly that scenario. Yeah, it's a shame what happened with Gnabry, but I kind of feel like ultimately he forced his way out of the club. You can understand why he did it, but he wanted to go. You know, he wanted to play every week. Felt like he wasn't going to get that chance at Arsenal. I think the real frustration was the fact that we'd stood by him through a lot of injury problems, and the minute he's fit, he was gone. You know, that's the difference between him and a lot of other young players. But, I think, sadly, that ship has sailed. I think it'll be at Bayern within a couple of years, probably.
Yeah, all right. Have you
If it is Bayern and not another big English team, that'd be more...
Yeah, interesting that he mentioned Chelsea, so maybe there's been some contact there. Who knows?
Scary. Have I got any more? This one I quite like. This is from Aman, who's at AmanATD on Twitter, and says, who would you rather see finish outside the top four, United or Spurs?
That's a really good question. I think probably...
We can have both, though. Let's cross all our fingers.
Of course, that could happen. I think probably United...
Yeah, I think so too, actually.
I'd love to see Spurs struggle at Wembley again next
there
season's
is that
Champions
bonus.
League, you know, and then have to play their Europa League games at Wembley in front of six people or whatever it is, you know, or selling tickets for £2 and what have you. So that would be good, but you know, I think it would be a big dent to the ego of Mourinho and Zlatan and all those guys. And I tell you what, I have to say, I can see why United fans really like him, but Ander Herrera, he's a right little cunt, isn't he?
He is. He's kind of Ramirez reborn, isn't he?
Yeah. He's doing it. Like, I mean, he's out there to do... He's clearly been given explicit instructions by Mourinho to be a complete spoiler as much as possible in midfield. But, you know, to get back to the question, I think it would hurt Manchester United a lot more. Tottenham have got this distraction of a new stadium being built, having to play at Wembley, you know, another season perhaps in the Champions League where things don't go well. I would prefer to see United finish out of the top four.
Yeah, and I think the fact that Spurs have got to build this stadium means that, you know, that kind of impedes their financial power slightly, even if they get Champions League qualification, as we know, you know, very much to our cost. So I think, I think if we can keep United out, I think we'll be sort of halting their return to the summit. And the longer we do that, the better, frankly.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, I think that's about it for this week. Although I do have one more, actually.
Oh, go on.
One very quick one. I should have read this before I even tried to pronounce. Oh, God damn it.
Is it the name you're struggling
with?
It's
the name. Nick Zelenikov. Zeleznikov.
Nick sent in a question.
Nick, I should have just gone with Nick, yeah. Who's at RussianBoy_NZ, who says, could our slow start be a tactical ploy to lull the opposition into a sense of supremacy and then tire them? And Scott Baker at Scotty_Baker wants to know, fitness staff have copped some flack in the past, but maybe now due some credit for our strong finishes / late wins.
There may be something in that. I think Arsenal look like a fit side at the moment, you know, and we the injury situation. I know we have some injuries now, but I do feel like the injury situation at the club has changed over the past couple of years. It's tended to be more impact injuries than muscular ones that have kept players out. Is it a tactical ploy? Probably not.
No.
Because really I don't think there's anything that settles you down and helps you, like an early goal. And if you take an early lead, it's so advantageous. And the stats back that up. So I would say no, not on purpose.
All right, I would agree with that. Okay, well, look, we'll leave it there. We've got a game against Burnley. Is it Saturday or Sunday?
It's Sunday, 2 p.m., I believe.
Sunday at 2 p.m., the worst kickoff of the week. Yeah. Okay. Well, look,
cancel your roasts, guys.
We will be back next week with another Arsecast Extra. I'll be here with an Arsecast on Friday, looking ahead to that exciting game against Burnley and all the rest of the stuff that's happened during the week. So until then, take it easy.
Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.